This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Bradley Trevor Grieve, welcome to Better Reading.
Hello, Cheryl. Nice to be back.
Yeah. Hey, do you know, we go way back, don't we?
We do. We do. To the dark ages of publishing, when it was just people spitting into charcoal grinds and rubbing them on paper.
Yeah. So I think we met with the Blue Day book.
I thought it was before. Yeah, I mean, we did. Yeah. That was my first published book. But I mean, yeah, you were well and truly ensconced as an industry heavyweight when I was just starting out. So we're talking 25 years.
And we had dinner at a Chinese restaurant in Haymarket. Do you remember that with Jane Proffitt?
Oh, yes, Barbecue King, of course.
Yeah.
Philip Lau's enterprise. I was a regular there two days a week for 14 years, and the privilege of being a loyal customer is that if I went on a weekend, and I rarely did, I didn't have to stand in line. I could just sit down by the fish tank. He would bring me a bottle of Tsingtao and I would get a table. And that was real power. That was real power. And so that was the benefit of being a loyal customer for over a decade. And Jane, you know, obviously JP and I, she was my first editor. She was a Random House in those days. I believe now she's with Allen & Unwin. And God, she was just wonderful. We're still good friends. In fact, she and her husband, the artist David Kirk, when they went on holiday to, I want to say, Cuba, not that long ago, they came back through LA so that we could catch up for lunch. And
lovely.
Yeah, we're still very, very close. Whenever I'm back home in Australia or whenever they're here, we catch up, which is nice.
Yeah, we spoke about this before we started recording, but I spend 3 or 4 months in San Francisco every year and have done for over 20 years now. And one time I came to visit you and you had planned this day. And I don't know if I told you this, right, but I'm going to tell you now. I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be so hard because I didn't have a car and I had to work it out by public transport, which I did. Which is
impressive.
Yeah, it's tough in LA.
It is.
And I was like, oh, all sort of grumpy. Oh, what's the day going to be like? Oh, it's a long way. Is it going to be worth it? And for me, and I often go back and look at the photos, it was one of the best days I have ever had. Really.
Oh,
it's up
there.
That's
so lovely. Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, look, I have, as you'll know, I have a very strict policy that I don't do any interviews in my house. I don't have any interviews, any journalists. Everybody wants to see your home. Everybody wants to see how you work. And there are aspects of that I don't mind, but I really preserve the idea of sanctuary. And I am a writer and a person who enjoys solitude. And so I really don't welcome the intrusion. So I've never allowed it for all these decades. So when you said you wanted to catch up and I was looking forward to it, I thought, where would be a place that if I hadn't been there before as an outsider, I would like to be taken? And that was the Huntington Library and Gardens. And it's one of my favorite escapes. In fact, as a family, we've been members for many years now, and we were there last weekend. We go there all the time.
It was wonderful.
Well, this incredible collection of books and artworks, and of course the gardens themselves. It's an extraordinary part of the greater history of Los Angeles. So I'm glad you enjoyed it because I know a lot of journos get, and obviously you and I live in several different worlds. You're not just, one of the most important publishing influences in Australia. You're more than a book journalist and reviewer and critic and a publishing veteran. You're also a friend, but still, once you put on that hat, that was it. It couldn't be inside my property. So I'm so glad you weren't offended and that you enjoyed it because it is a very beautiful place.
Well, and I feel as though I would never have known about it had it not been for you.
It's not that well known outside of this part of the world. I'd been here a few years before I got a chance to go there, and it was bigger and more beautiful than I could have imagined. And what's nice is the garden was broken down into several sections. And there is an Australian section of the garden where I used to go when I was homesick. And they have blue gums there from my native Tasmania. And that always makes me feel better. But I have to say that the real attraction of the gardens themselves is the cactus, succulents, which is the envy of the world. I don't think anyone who hears the word cactus can appreciate how beautiful and how varied the forms of these plants are. Mm. And then, of course, you've got the actual Gutenberg Bible and all sorts of great, extraordinary print work sitting in the library. So it's a very special place.
I bet you no one's ever met you there going via public transport.
You are the first and last, I think, that I'll ever achieve. I mean, that's...
it's a big one.
If you live in a major city like Melbourne or Sydney or whatever, and you know, you talk about public transport, it's fairly well laid out. And also we think of it as little pockets, you know, and so you tend to stay in your own little regional bubble. But when people say Los Angeles, they always tend to speak of it as the whole. And it's monumental. And the distance from, say, you know, the airport to Hollywood to Venice Beach to where we are up in the mountains, we're all still part of Los Angeles, but it may as well be saying I've gone from the Blue Mountains to, you know, to Penrith to Bondi. It's just monumental distances, and it's not very well catered for in terms of public transport, because there was a conscious municipal decision many years ago to move away from public transport in order to favor the automobile. And so this is a city built for cars. It is an endless growling sprawl of highways and freeways. So yeah, getting about on a bus is, I mean, you should be given, if not a medal, certainly a chocolate frog.
Certainly. Okay. I want to go back, before we start talking about your new book called Broken Girl, I want to go back to where it all started, because you've got such a big career. Tell me about school. Tell me how you ended up in the army, and then tell me how you came to writing.
Well, drew my first breath of air in Tasmania, where my mother and father were working at the hospital there, and also for the University of Tasmania in Hobart. And then when I was still portable, my mother and father smuggled me out of the country for their continued studies in the UK before they went on to run hospitals in Southeast Asia. So I was an internationalist at a very young age, which I think has served me well. But I was also somewhat, this peripatetic lifestyle means you're forever displaced and didn't have the kind of roots that a lot of people enjoy. I know I'm very envious of my wife, who grew up in San Antonio, and she has, you know, family, friends going back generations. I don't have that. And I say that because I think one of the reasons I joined the military, other than being, you know, young and a little bit foolhardy, and there was this sort of prepubescent patriotic fervor, which was, yes, to sort of jump out of planes and roll in the mud and blow things up, but also it was a binding action. It was a sense of belonging. You know, once you're an Australian soldier, it doesn't get any more Australian than that, regardless of where you come from. So I like to think that was part of it. I graduated from the Royal Military College Duntroon, and for my sins was granted my request to serve in the infantry and then as a paratrooper commander. And it was a wonderful experience, brutal, painful, and heartbreaking. You know, a number of my friends and fellow soldiers died, and it's something that I reflect on to this day. I think one of the most formative experiences was when I was sent on a sort of an exchange, an academic exchange program with the Royal Military Academy in Thailand, in Chulalongkorn Klao, and then sent to the Thai-Cambodian border. This is back in the late 80s. That's how old I am. And in those days, they were still working out how to mop up the Khmer Rouge, and particularly to bring Pol Pot to order, and they achieved one and not the other. I think Khmer Rouge is still very much a part of the Cambodian political subtext to this day. And I visited the Site 2 refugee camp, which was run by the United Nations. And it was both an incredibly hopeful and hopeless situation. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people crammed into a few small hectares. I remember one particular woman whose entire dwelling was a tent house made out of a single blue tarpaulin that had been wrapped around four star pickets. And then she had a hammock from one corner to the top, the bottom of one pole to the adjacent top of the other. So she would sleep in a hammock, sort of leaning on her feet. And everything she owned, a few tins and pots and pans and a couple of pairs of clothes and rags, were underneath her. And at that time, you know, I didn't recall meeting any men or boys in their sort of teens or older who weren't missing hands or feet as a result of landmines and booby traps and torture. And the Khmer Rouge had infiltrated the camp. They were sending their wounded and disguised as civilians to be treated by the UN, you know, peacekeeping forces and their medical team. So, you know, to be very honest about some of the dark arts, one of the reasons it's better to wound a soldier than to kill them is because of the logistic drain of caring for that soldier and the damage to the morale of the enemy. In this case, none of that burden was being shouldered by the Khmer Rouge. It was all falling back on the UN. It was a flawed system, and it was absolutely heartbreaking. And yet, many of the people I met there were so hopeful and determined. I recall this sort of dirt floor hut where groups were learning how to assemble, disassemble and assemble a small motor from a lawnmower. And it gleamed like a fire engine. It had been polished and cared for so lovingly. And they were determined that should they ever be led into Thailand or some other nation, they would have a career ready for these young men and women. They were so determined to make a future for themselves. And I think about that all the time. And it led to the Blue Day Book in its own way, because when you're trying to become an artist of any kind, and certainly a writer, it's a struggle. It's really hard just to get the opportunity to show what you can do rather than to even just to enjoy success. And I was struggling after I left the military, and I won't get into all of that other than the fact that I got very ill on an operation in Northern Australia and Indonesia, ended up with a very serious respiratory condition, which ended my time as an elite combat soldier. Having left the military, having achieved some success, but not having the career I'd hoped for, I was demoralized. And I had felt in one context that I had paid my dues. I had sacrificed my health and well-being for my country. I was entitled to pursue something that I loved without any kind of notion of a career. Rear trajectory. I just needed to do the creative thing that I always wanted to do, but had been largely discouraged by my parents, who very loving and supportive, but were very conventional, you know.
I just want to interject there. I've actually forgotten to introduce you formally, but I think everybody knows you, that it's Bradley Trevor Grieve, author of The Blue Day Book and author of Penguin Bloom, which is why we met in LA, I remember. Anyway, sold millions of copies. In preparation of speaking with you today, have been thinking about the Blue Day Book because, as you talked about earlier, I've been in the business a long time. I'm old and I've been here a long time. I think I've been in the trade for over 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I have seen books, you know, fly, and I have seen many, many good books just absolutely disappear, never get an audience. And there are some books that I think break the cycle of the way I see it is there is a core of readers, right? And they are regular readers. They are readers that are going to buy books regardless. They love story. Sure. They love reading. But then there's an outer shell, if you like, of people that only kind of tap in and tap out when a story speaks to them. And, you know, that would be J.K. Rowling, that would be, you know, Harry Potter, that would be The Da Vinci Code, that would be those books where there's something that tapped into the psychic of those people that aren't regular readers who wanted to know the story. And I think The Blue Day Book was of that time. I think because it was a simple little black and white, beautifully produced.
Very simple.
Lovely affirmation, whatever. And I remember when I bought it, like when I had a look at it and thinking, I wonder who the market is for this book, right? Who is it that's going to buy this book? Now, their gift books can be really popular because they sit at the counter and, you know, you and I know that. But this went beyond. I mean, millions and millions of copies, right? It became The Da Vinci Code. It became Harry Potter. And why did it? And when I think about the time, I think these things don't happen by accidents. I think with Harry Potter, it was the escapism that tapped into that psyche. I think with The Da Vinci Code, it was that whole conspiracy around religion that tapped into that.
That's interesting, sure.
And I think with the Blue Day book, it was people were looking for comfort. People were looking for affirmation. People wanted to read something that was quite beautiful. And that's why it sold millions of copies. Have you got another view on that?
I don't know if I have a parallel view. I have a different approach to it in that I think that we all struggle to articulate how we're feeling.
Yeah.
Especially when we're not feeling happy.
Mm.
And sometimes we feel ashamed of the small things that have pushed us into unhappiness.
Mm.
And I don't know whether it's being Australian, this notion of suck it up and get on with it kind of thing, or she'll be right, shrug it off, don't worry about it. Both of those two largely positive mindsets can be quite destructive when you're not in a good place. And I think the Blue Day book gave you permission, gave the reader permission to forge a positive perspective about some of the small and yet overwhelming feelings that they have. And it was a way, I mean, it was a truly a gift book in the sense that people bought it for others. And in that sense, it was a way of having the conversation without having the conversation. Mm. Not in a shallow sense, but rather, and not necessarily in a prescriptive sense either, but more in the sense that I want you to feel better. And this helped me feel better. Could you try it? And I know that was a big reason why it succeeded. But I really feel, again, when I was doing the original book, and it was inspired to a certain degree by the old funny black and white photos on the back of Life magazine back in the 1970s when I was a kid in Southeast Asia. There's only two English language magazines that we would get regularly, and one was National Geographic and the other was Life magazine. And Life had a feature on the back cover which said Life Smiles Back, and it was a very funny photograph. And that inspired me to do that structure. I was already a cartoonist at the Herald, of course, but that juxtaposition of text and image made sense to me as a cartoonist. But those images and the initial version, the initial draft had pictures of people as well as animals. And I found when I was sort of showing it to friends, they would sort of didn't respond to the funny pictures of people so much as they did to the pictures of animals. And I thought this through. And the reason, I believe, is that we inherently think of people as being flawed because we see ourselves as flawed, and we just as incorrectly think of animals as being perfect and above any level of fraudulence. And that's obviously, as a wildlife expert, I can tell you is completely untrue. But it is interesting that we see that. So I changed all the pictures to be just animals. And the benefit of that I realize, and I think this is the key to the book's broad reach, is that when you see the animal, you see something that in your mind is blameless, that is a victim of circumstances beyond their control. It did nothing wrong to deserve it. You know, if you ever had a friend go through a divorce and you love that friend and you go, oh, I love you so much, I'm here for whatever you need, and you wish them well, but you also think, oh, they probably screwed up to some degree as well. It wasn't always on their partner, whoever. We just like that. With an animal, you don't think that. So with the animals, you think of the animal as being unblemished, and you think of the animal, you feel immediate sympathy and empathy with the animal. Here's the funny thing, because it's not a person, you put yourself into the animal's skin. And so you see yourself in that situation. And I deliberately chose situations which were universal. Mm. And so in that regard, the book became incredibly personal. I mean, the author's job is to disappear and let the reader own the book. And the Blue Day book was very good at that because of the pictures. Mm. The photographs were so funny and so unusual. And the readers could suddenly be in that moment and connect at quite a profound emotional level because they knew exactly how that felt, and the book became them. So that's sort of my, I guess, a technical explanation to why I think it succeeded. But I do think it comes from a place of we struggle to tell people how we feel.
Mm. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Also, too, I think, and I don't have any statistics around these, so it's just coming from the heart, but I think at the time, I think it was the most gifted, as you were saying, the most given book, if you like. They didn't just buy one, they bought multiple copies. You know, I think my dad will like this, I think my best friend will like it, I will, you know, and I think that that added to the success of it.
Well, that was the lucky because of the price point, you know, and in those days, bookstores were that's where you bought your books. I mean, Amazon didn't exist. And when it came into existence, it was initially a sideshow. And so we had these things at the front of counter. And plus, it was a very novel execution. I mean, the format was a square I drew on a napkin and showed to Jane Palfreyman and said, I think it should be this size.
Yeah.
And now that's an industry standard. So I think it was a novel execution, but it struck a nerve. And it goes to what we always say about good books, is that if you write for yourself, and as I mentioned before, I was thinking about my struggle as a would-be author and then thinking about the people that I saw in Cambodia and thinking, who am I to complain? Mm-hmm. Who am I to complain? I needed to find a fresh perspective on my struggle and acknowledge the suffering that I was feeling, but also put it in a greater context and relish the opportunity that I had that they never had, which was to move forward and try again. And so I think when you do something from a very personal place, however simple, it ends up being very powerful.
Mm. Okay, tell me about Broken Girl. Where did that come from?
Broken Girl is something of a new thing for me because it's my first ever non-visual book. It's not illustrated at all. There's no illustration. There's no photographs. And that was exciting. But that's not to say it isn't full of surprises structurally. It definitely is. And that same approach that I've taken to all my work, which was, if I was to come to this problem for the very first time, knowing nothing, how would I approach it? And I've done that with the Blue Day book. I did that with my Bertrand Russell book, In Praise of Idleness. Penguin Bloom was a new approach to a biography. We're just looking for these ways to do something new and to not feel fettered to industry standards. And so Broken Girl is a very beautiful work of nonfiction. It's creative nonfiction. It is the story of an extraordinary young woman called Caroline, who was originally from Brazil, but endured a number of was the victim of several violent crimes before she finally immigrated to Australia. And there she met the man of her dreams. And they bought a home together in Bondi, and everything was just looking wonderful. And she was hoping to start a new business. And they went on a romantic holiday to Europe, where she once again became the victim of hideous violence and suffered just extraordinary and catastrophic injury, should have died and left with serious brain damage, and was stuck in Spain as COVID swept through Europe. And that prevented her from coming home. And when she finally did come home a year later, after convalescing and rehabilitating in Brazil with her mother and stepfather, what she found in Australia when she came back to Bondi in Sydney was that nothing was as it should have been. Nothing was as she recalled. Her home wasn't her home. Her lover wasn't a lover. The friends were no longer her friends, and she couldn't reconcile the past from present. And so the book is sort of, in a way, something of a detective story where she has to solve the mystery of her life. So it's a very beautiful, very powerful story, but it's also, you know, and it's uplifting, but also very dark and sad compared to my previous work. And even those who've enjoyed Penguin Bloom, I think if you enjoy Penguin Bloom, you'll enjoy Broken Girl, but it's a very different book than Penguin Bloom.
How did the story come to you?
Well, one of the benefits of having a successful career, and certainly with Penguin Bloom, which became a movie, is that a lot of people write to me now asking if I would be interested in writing their story, which is very flattering, but also, you know, quite taxing and overwhelming. I get a lot of these requests, and some, what I know from working with people who have suffered a great deal is that they just want to be heard. They just want to be acknowledged. They feel invisible. And I write back to everybody. I decline almost 100% of inquiries. I just can't do it. There are some that I can't relate to. A mother wanted to talk about how her two sons were addicted to video games and then went to India and some place in India and came back cured. And as someone who doesn't play video games, I couldn't possibly hope to connect with that. Now, I've never suffered serious brain damage or been paralyzed either, but I've, you know, had plenty of horrible accidents. I've had 21 surgeries. I know what it's like to thinking that you've lost important part of yourself. And I know how painful it is to come back to any semblance of normality. In this instance, the connection was much more intimate because Caroline had enjoyed the movie Penguin Bloom before she read the book. And she went to one of the talks that Sam Bloom, who's a subject of those books, Penguin Bloom and Sam Bloom, Heartache and Birdsong, she gives these talks. And she went to one of Sam's lectures and afterwards was introduced to Sam by a mutual friend. And Sam Bloom actually suggested that she reach out to me. And this is fairly early in Caroline's recovery. And so as someone with a traumatic brain injury, she was, the nice way to say it would be very childlike at that time. You know, she was very, she was definitely struggling to articulate any kind of cohesive communication, both on the page or verbally. And her comprehension levels were certainly very limited as well. And so she reached out to me. And what impressed me about her was that she had already made an attempt to write her story. And when speaking as a writer, and I know many of your audience are also writers, and some are, most are, we're all just passionate readers as well. But for those that are readers and not writers, one of the things that's frustrating to a writer from someone who doesn't write is this notion that it's effortless for us. And it's not. It's incredibly hard work. It's soul destroying. It keeps you awake at night. You're forever making notes. You're forever doubting yourself. It's a very difficult process, but there's this notion that it somehow is automated, you know, whether it's AI or making a standardized object like a plate or a table, that it somehow should just happen automatically. And it's absolutely not the case. So this notion of, okay, I'll just tell you a few things and you fill it all in, is a very frustrating one. And particularly with people who have no exposure to publishing before. And in this instance, I was just delighted that, yes, she had this desire to share her story for many of the reasons that people who suffer have, but she'd also made an attempt to write it down. Now, she'd only written a few small chapters herself. The whole document was less than 30 pages. And of that, her mother had written a section, her lover had written a section, her lover's best friend had written a section, all giving her an account of what happened, knowing that she had no idea. And it wasn't a particularly comprehensive document, but the fact that it had been codified, the fact that it had actually been put down, I really respected that. And I thought, this is someone I can work with. Mm-hmm. And I was also, I'm not going to lie to you, I was intrigued from a literary point of view of the challenge of writing the book through the lens of someone with brain damage. With Penguin Bloom, it was an emotional and physical disability, but this was definitely a new approach to telling a story. And even though I swore after two Penguin Bloom books, I wouldn't write any more works of nonfiction, I probably said that to your face at the Huntington Gardens. I'm done. If I don't retire, I've definitely retired from nonfiction. And because in order to write these stories, you have to immerse yourself for a very long time in the pain of others. And that is very taxing. I don't want to compare my pain to theirs. Theirs is far greater, but it is not easy and it is exhausting. And I said I wouldn't do it. And I lied, Cheryl. I lied to your beautiful face. And this came across and I thought, that's interesting. But she asked me if I would look at it. And I did. She asked me if I would edit it into a book. I said, A, that's not possible. And B, no, I won't. But I said, if you want some advice and some good ghostwriters and so forth and how to contact other authors through the Australian Society of Authors, I gave her a whole bunch of connections and links and emails. And I checked in every few months to see how she was doing. And she finally got some interest, I think, from a ghostwriter or a few others, but it never went anywhere. And I think a year later, I finally said, look, if you just trust me and let me write it the way I want to write it, I will write this book. And she was thrilled. And, you know, two and a half years later, here we are.
Do you know of the author Trent Dalton, the Australian
yes.
author?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Voice follows from him. Yep.
Yeah, Matt, and a wonderful television adaptation. He's got a new book out now, I think.
So Boys Swallows Universe, Love Stories, and I can't remember what the other one's called. I love Trent. You remind me of Trent.
Thank you, because he's younger and more handsome and very successful, so I appreciate that.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about looks, but I feel that there are some people that write with a heart. Another person is Chloe Hooper.
I love Chloe.
Yeah, but I feel that with your writing and going as far back as Blue Jay Book, particularly Penguin Bloom, there is, and I know this sounds simplistic, but there is kind of writing from the heart, that the empathy tool that you have, that Chloe has, that Trent has, you know, Helen Garner, when she wrote Joe Chippet's Consolation, where you kind of sit back from the story. You're in the story, but you're not in the story. And I think that that is a really unique storytelling process, and one I'm very drawn to, you know, and I think a lot of people are, because I think there's an honesty and integrity about it.
Well, that's first of all, lovely to hear. I think that one of the things that I enjoy, that I feel I have a license to enjoy because of my previous career, is to sit with emotion and to sit with feelings in the broader sense, you know, positive and negative,
and not just walk away from them.
No, you have to be strong enough to admit your vulnerability. And I think it's such a privilege to be let into someone's life. And I say that as a very private person. If I have my daughter, somebody, it's a great privilege for them to step inside my life. And I'm not a hypocrite. I feel the same way when I'm working with a Sam Bloom or with Caroline. I'm drawn to the stories where, as a sense of duty, an obligation, where the subject of the story can't tell it themselves for any number of reasons. In this case, not just because they're not a writer, but they're also someone with a traumatic brain injury. And that's especially so when there's been a great injustice. In Sam's case, she's a very physical person. Now, fortunately, she's still a physical person, and she's a 3-time world surfing champion. But in this case, this notion of the cruelty and the indignity of the way that Caroline was treated by people that were probably my neighbors back when I lived in Bondi 20, 30 years ago. There's great injustice to the story. And as a soldier, I still stand up to injustice. And as someone who is now comfortable with gentleness and comfortable with feelings, however discomforting those feelings are, I really do take pride and purpose in immersing myself in that story and trying to articulate it for everybody and not being afraid to be a little emotional. If you cry and laugh reading one of my books, it's because I have laughed and cried. And it was interesting because my wife has obviously read the first copy of the book that I received in my hands. I give to my wife, and she was crying during a pivotal scene in the book. And the way she described it, I knew exactly which passage of the book it was, because I remember just sobbing, writing this down, and just feeling so sad for Caroline and what happened to her. And not just because in itself it was cruel and unfair, but also because she wasn't fully able to comprehend the aspects of the unfairness and the cruelty. She just was left with the pain itself. And I thought that was really heartbreaking.
Bradley, we're out of time. Always, always a pleasure. You really, I think, you know, bring so much to people's stories. A beautiful writer. The book is called Broken Girl. Yeah, maybe I'll come and see you next time in LA and we can go back to the gardens.
Yes, there are also other secret nooks of LA I could show to you. And I think you'll enjoy it. Actually, before we do sign off, can I just, because this is a very literary group.
Yeah.
Can I just point out some of the things that are unique about the structure of this book that I haven't seen before? I'd be interested to hear if you've seen them before.
Yeah.
So my goal when telling this story was to not just share Caroline's experience, but to somehow make that experience accessible, experiential for the reader. And so the way the book is structured is the reader becomes someone who has a brain injury. And you get little tiny fragments of emotional information that doesn't become cohesive until the end of the book. Mm. And that's, so you'll see very short sentences and very poetic in nature, very emotional in structure. And then you have in substance, and then you, that was also an accessibility choice. I wanted to make sure that Caroline herself and other readers that have issues with comprehension could enjoy the book. I want to make sure everyone can read it. So it has to be simple and light. But a couple of things that happen. First of all, you'll notice that the chapter numbers run in reverse to zero and then start again because Caroline's life ends and begins again. Secondly, you'll see that we change fonts three times. And each time you see a different font, what you're seeing is a measure of the degree to which Caroline recalls what had happened. So there are three different aspects of that. And then you'll notice that when you get to the section when she's in hospital, the chapter structure, instead of having a new chapter on a new page, they run on from each other because chapters are a way of measuring time. And when in hospitals, and I've had a lot of experience with the hospitals, both my parents were medical professionals. And as I mentioned before, I've had 21 surgeries myself. Hospitals are like casinos. You know, they run day and night, time becomes a blur. And certainly when you're in a coma, it has no meaning. So there's all these subtle clues throughout the book that gradually drag you into Caroline's mindset that I found really exciting and enjoyable as a writer. And again, this doesn't come from anything but being passionately naive about the structure of a nonfiction book and saying, how could it be done? Mm-hmm. And I'm just so grateful to Caroline and to Hachette for giving me the free rein to do it, because you've ended up with a work of nonfiction that I think is as unique as Caroline herself.
Oh, I think it's extraordinarily unique, and I think it's mesmerizing as well. And you're right, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen that format anywhere else. But then I don't expect anything different from you. It's always going to be a surprise, right?
You know what? I'm glad I try that, because I like to, you know, I hate to be the guy that quotes Nietzsche, but, you know, life is 100 times too short for us to bore ourselves. I should have been dead a long time ago, but I'm not, and I like to make the most of it.
Thank you. BTG, you're wonderful.
Thanks, Cheryl.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.